Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We are in Exodus 10 tonight. Tonight we'll cover the plague of darkness, and then we'll get to the death of the firstborn, and hopefully get a chance then to talk about some of the theology of Passover, because it obviously has a lot of heavy-duty New Testament Christian connections that we'll have to talk about as well. So let's start with the plague of darkness. Now, as we've been looking at each of these plagues successively, I've been talking about how God very specifically says, and we'll see it again soon when we get to chapter 12, we'll get to read that verse yet again, that God is real specific in saying that he's bringing about these plagues to mock and make fun of all the gods of Egypt. Because in the Egyptian culture, they had a whole pantheon of different gods, and gods for absolutely everything from buildings to insects to the big things. And tonight we're going to get to one of the biggest things. Now, every culture in the history of the world that has any kind of religion attached to it, one of the primary sources of heathen religion is the sun. The Egyptians are no different. They had gods that they associated with the sun, Ra being the biggest of them. So here we are in this Christmas season, coming up on the Saturnalia, the winter solstice, and the Saturnalia festival that happened in so many of the ancient Babylonish and then passed down to many of the Gaelic and, yes, the Roman. Gaelic and Roman cultures. All of those cultures had sun worship as an integral part of their religious calendar. And so this time of year, when the days get short and there's not as much sun, they, of course, would begin begging the sun to come back. And then starting from about December 25th forward, the days start getting longer. And so they had their feast every December to the sun, and it was the rebirth of the unconquerable sun, S-U-N. And then the days would start getting longer, and that meant they could grow food, and that meant that they'd be warm, and that meant that they could travel again, and everything in their life improved when the sun returned. So sun worship is an absolutely integral part of every heathen type of worship. Now, how many of you have ever heard of a halo? Do you know that the Bible never talks about halos? There are no halos in the Bible anywhere. Do you know where the concept of halos comes from?
The sun.
It comes from the sun, yes. I'm now going to prove my artistic genius with stick figures. During the Middle Ages, particularly Roman-type art, Renaissance art, that tried to depict the saints of God, whether it was Mary or whether it was any of the apostles or anybody, they would always draw them with that bright yellow disc around them. Have you seen that? You've seen it a lot, haven't you? Well, that's the sun that's behind them, because all the way back into Babylonish culture, those people who were graduated people, who were spiritual people, were connected inextricably with the sun, because the sun was the source of all life and was the chief image for worship. So if God is going to, the God of heaven, the God of the Bible, if he is going to poke a stick at gods that are not gods, which is how this whole conversation with Pharaoh began, God telling Moses, I am. That's how he identified himself. I am the God that is. I'm the God that exists. By contrast, all those other gods don't exist. Well, as we've seen these plagues successively becoming more and more intrusive and progressively bigger, and God proving that he's in charge of everything from the water turned to blood, or the frogs, or the insects, or the hail, or the boils, showing that he's in charge of men and sickness and insects and everything. Now he's going to show that he's the God that can blot out their most powerful God, the sun, the source of all life. He can hold it back for 3 days if he wants, and he can let it go because it's part of his creation. It is not the creator. It is not a God. It is not anything that can help you in a time of trouble. One of the things I've tried to point out with each of these successive plagues is that it was God mocking Egyptian gods, who not only seem to be powerless against the superior might of Jehovah, the God of Israel, but they also didn't help the Egyptians, no matter how much they cried out to the God of the frogs. Didn't stop the frogs. No matter how many boils they were covered with and as sick as they got, or the burrowing insects that were up under their skin, as much as they cried out to the gods that would help them in those instances, their gods did nothing for them. So not only was Jehovah, Yahweh, the God of Israel, the God who identifies himself as the God who made heaven and earth, a very important designation of which God we're talking about, the God who actually is, the way that he mocked all those other gods was not only to infiltrate their territory and mess with them, but then to prove that they were powerless to help the people who were suffering. And so tonight we're going to see a plague of darkness, 3 full days of absolute darkness, God showing that the God of Israel was superior to the sun, which was the head of all their gods. Now, just in case you think sun worship is over and done with, I'll just say this and keep moving. The Saturnalia feast is still with us. It's just the Christ Mass. And instead of being the birth of the unconquerable sun, S-U-N, we just refer to it as the birth of the unconquered sun, S-O-N. But Jesus wasn't born on December 25th. It's just a Christianization of an ancient pagan feast. And in a few months, when the Feast of Ishtar gets here, everybody's going to run out at sunup. Sunrise festival, sunrise service at all the churches. He's going to run out at sunup. They're going to face toward the rising of the sun in the east, and they're going to think that has something to do with Jesus. And it has nothing to do with Jesus. It has to do with the worship of Ishtar, or her name is Semiramis in some cultures, who gave birth to Tammuz, and she said she was impregnated by the sun. And so Tammuz was the son of the sun. So this mixture of Christian and heathen concepts continues to this very day, and people by their traditions will continue to do things that actually do celebrate the sun instead of the creator who created the universe, including the sun. God, by the way, if you think about it in the largest cosmology, God is not impressed by the tiny little star that heats Earth. He's got billions of those in his universe. You understand? So that one that we refer to as the sun, which we're highly dependent on, which is the source of light and life here on planet Earth, God is not impressed. God sits in a light that is so complete and so continuous and so bright that in the book of Revelation, it says that in the New Jerusalem, there won't be any sun or moon or any lights in the heaven. You won't need it, because the light of God is going to light us all. So he's not dependent on the sun, and he can mess with the sun anytime he wants. And when he makes the new heavens and the new earth, he can burn up the sun and be done with it. So you have to remember that the planets are nothing more than part of God's creation. But typical of human beings, Paul writes about it in Romans 1 and 2, humans have a tendency to look at the creation and worship it rather than worship the creator who created everything. Whether that's worshiping other people who are part of the creation, or whether that's worshiping stars and suns and planets, and looking at the zodiac and thinking that maybe if the stars were aligned a certain way at the time that I was born, that's going to have a certain effect over me, instead of saying that it is God's providence that is in control of your life. People have a long, rich history of looking to the creation, looking to the planets, looking to the sun, looking to the stars, looking to anything they can find that will make them feel like they're connected in some way to the cosmos. I was watching TV the other day, and Wayne Dyer was on. Do you know who that is? Dr. Wayne Dyer, who in the 70s wrote a book called Your Erroneous Zones. Anybody read that book? It was very popular, big book. I read it too. Yeah. So he was on TV the other day, and he's selling his new series of books and tapes and CDs and everything else for several hundred dollars. And he, during his talk, and I listened to about an hour of it, he used the word spiritual about every 2-3 minutes. And he used the word spirit a lot. And he said, you have to live in the spirit. When you have a life in the spirit, when you live in the Spirit. And every once in a while he would say, when you have the God connection, when you're connected to God. But he would never identify what God he was talking about, which seemed to be this God of nature, this very vague God. And he talked about the Spirit without ever talking about what Spirit. But spirits are created beings. God created every angel, every human, every person. Only the Holy Spirit of God is a continuous eternal spirit. So if you're talking about being connected to anything, any spirit, and you're not identifying what spirit, you're playing with fire. Because there are lots of spirits out there, but they're not God. And you can be spiritual and be connected to some spirit out there and have that be no benefit to your eternal soul whatsoever. In fact, it can be a huge detriment because you have chosen to worship the creation rather than the Creator. So let's get into this tonight, because God is going to mess with their largest source of life and worship, which is the sun, and he's going to darken it. Now, I've been reading from different notes the last few weeks, things that I've dug up out of different encyclopedias and dictionaries and such. The plague of darkness was an insult to Egypt's religion and its entire culture. The sun god Amon-Ra was considered one of the greatest blessings in all the land of Egypt. Both Amon and Ra were originally two separate deities. Ra was the sun god whose cult was centered in the city of Heliopolis, and is usually represented in art as having a man's body and a falcon's head surmounted by a solar disk. See where we get the halo thing? If you've looked at Egyptian hieroglyphs, or even if you've watched, what was that movie with the big time machine where they went to a different planet? And what was it?
Stargate,
yeah. And they had all that Egyptian culture and art and everything. They had these men with the falcon heads. Well, those are images of Amon-Ra, the sun god of Egypt. Amon and Ra were originally two separate deities. In art, a man's body with a falcon's head surmounted by a solar disk, Ra was believed to sail across the sky in a boat each day and then go under the world at night, and that explained the sunrise and the sunset. Reading from Will Durant's book, History of Civilization, Volume 1, he wrote, "The moon was a god, perhaps the oldest of all the gods that were worshipped in Egypt. But in the official theology of Egypt, the greatest of the gods was the sun. Sometimes it was worshipped as the supreme deity Ra or Re. He was the bright father who fertilized Mother Earth with rays of penetrating heat and light. Sometimes it was a divine calf who was born anew at every dawn, sailing the sky slowly in a celestial boat. And then it was born anew every dawn, and then it descended into the west at evening, like an old man tottering to his grave. Or the sun was the god Horus, taking the graceful form of a falcon, flying majestically across the heavens, day by day as if in supervision of all his realm, and becoming one of the recurrent symbols of Egyptian religion and royalty. Always Ra, or the sun, was considered the creator. At his first rising, he saw the earth, desert and bare, and he flooded it with his energizing rays, and then all living things, vegetable, animal, and human, sprung up pell-mell from his eyes and have been scattered over the world ever since." So you can imagine that if you are Yahweh, Jehovah, the God of Israel, who has been identified all the way through the book of Genesis and into the early parts of the book of Exodus so far, one of his names is the God who made heaven and earth. God wants us to know that that's him. He's the one who did that. The Genesis account starts right off with, "In the beginning was God, and God made the heavens and the earth." Right away, he's identified as being that. So you can see why God would take it very personally and why it would be an affront to his absolute sovereignty as the God of everything when people worship the sun, which is only one minute part of his whole creation, and they worship the sun as being the creator of everything. It is a perfect example of human beings worshiping the creation instead of the creator. And by the way, we won't get into it, but I'll just drop this idea and then you can muse on it later in your own time. If you think that this idea of creature worship and worshiping the creation more than the creator has gone away, it is still alive and well. It's just living under the guise of science. It's called Darwinism, that human beings and all life and everything just sprung out of the primordial ooze and didn't need a creator in order to get here. That's just another form of human beings worshiping themselves and saying, hey, we're the top of the food chain, you know, the survival of the fit. We've survived this long because we're just better than every other creature. And it's just under the guise of science, but it is still the religion of worshiping the creation rather than the creator. Things don't change that much. In Egyptian mythology, Horus was the god of light who personified the life-giving power of the sun. He was usually represented as a falcon-headed man wearing a sun disc as a crown, and the reigning kings of Egypt were believed to be incarnations of the god Horus. Why is that so important? Because Pharaoh is sitting there representing Horus. And here comes the real god to mess with him and say one more time, you're nothing in front of me. I'm God, you're a speck, you're a man. Your life is in the next breath that goes through your nostrils. If I plug up your nostrils for 5 minutes, you're dead. And yet, I'm the god of Horus, I'm the incarnation of Horus, who is the creator of all things. You can see why God would say, how about I drown you and your army and take your firstborn and show that you're no god at all. So once again, the gods of Egypt are going to lay silent. Let's go read it from the Bible. Exodus 10, let's start at verse 21. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward the sky, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, even a darkness, these next words are incredible, a darkness that may be felt. Can you imagine that sort of darkness? A darkness where if you were to light a torch, the darkness would consume the light. The kind of darkness that you can't light, and a darkness that is so oppressive it can be felt. So Moses stretched out his hand toward the sky, and there was a thick darkness in all the land of Egypt for 3 days. And they did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place. They didn't get out of bed, they didn't get up off a chair and try to travel for 3 whole days, but all the sons of Israel had light in their dwellings. So here again, you have God demonstrating his phenomenal sovereignty over everything he has created. Because we're talking about the same God who entered into the great cosmos of nothingness and said things like, let there be light. And Genesis says, and there was light. We're talking about the God who separates light from darkness, who put the stars in the heavens in the sky so that there would be great lights in the sky to light the planet, who created day and night, who created the planets circling around the sun and in their elliptical orbits. This is the God who created all that according to his own design and own plan, and now he's showing that his sovereignty over light and dark is so complete that he could actually tell this darkness that could be felt, this darkness that was so imposing that people didn't get up, people didn't go anywhere, people didn't do anything for 3 whole days because it was so dark, and yet that darkness came right up to the edge of Goshen and stopped. And then it was light over here. That's a really sovereign God we're talking about. This is the same God, by the way, who can enter into the darkest of hearts. This is the same God who can enter the darkness of the deepest, most depraved mind. And the same way that he said, let there be light, and in his universe there was light, he can come up to any dark mind and say, let there be light, and that human is enlightened. I talk all the time about the fact that real, genuine Christianity is a revealed religion. It has to be revealed to you. God has to open your mind and your heart to be able to understand it, to have the capacity. And so that language of light is used all the way through the Bible then. Paul, writing in the Thessalonian letter, says that one of the reasons that we're not appointed to wrath is that we're not the children of darkness. Instead, he says we're the children of light. Well, if you're the children of light, you are the children who have been energized by God, the one who creates light. Now, all of science tells us, all of the natural order tells us that it takes energy to create light. But darkness is nothing more than the lack of energy. Darkness is the natural state of the complete lack of energy. So in order for there to be light, there has to be some energy that creates the light. And then when that energy runs out, things get dark again. Here we can prove that. Get a flashlight, put a battery in it, turn the flashlight on. After a while, the battery runs out, there's no more energy. Does the light stay on?
No,
all of nature runs back to darkness. Leave human beings to themselves. Do they get better?
No.
Do they gradually improve on their own?
No.
Take a child, as soon as he's born, stick him in a cave somewhere, shove food to him through a rock so that he never interacts with any other humans. Don't teach him any morality. Don't teach him any thought processes or skills. Will he come out of there a great philosopher?
No,
absolutely not. No, because what is it? The second rule of
thermodynamics.
Thank you very much. Yeah, the universe is in a constant state of entropy, which means it's all running down. The universe is not running up. Things are not getting better. Leave wood out in the rain, it does not improve. Leave metal in the rain, it gets rusty. Everything in the universe runs down. It takes energy to make it better. So God had to intervene in the darkness and say, let there be light. And then he had to exercise his power in order for light to exist. We know that that second rule of thermodynamics being true, we know that someday our sun is going to burn out. If everything remains the way it is and the universe keeps ticking, eventually our sun is going to grow bigger and then explode and then implode on itself if it does what every other star in the universe does. So even that light is not a continuous light. It's not a constant light. The only place in the universe that you find constant light is God. And any place else in his dark universe you find light, God energized it. It is only the power and energy of God that creates light in his dark universe. So whether you're talking spiritually, whether you're talking intellectually, whether you're talking physically, we're always talking about the power it takes to create light, and that's always God. So notice what he did here in dividing the Egyptians, who throughout this whole scenario, God has been calling your people, speaking to Pharaoh. He says, your people. And he has said several times, I will make a division between your people and my people. And your people are the Egyptians who get all these plagues on them. My people, the Israelites, who don't get those plagues put on them because they're my people. They became my people because I chose them and said, you're going to be my people because I chose you to be my people. We've already at length looked into the fact that the Israelites were not particularly better than the Egyptians. They just happened to have been chosen by God and therefore they didn't undergo all these plagues. And so when God leaves the Egyptians to themselves, where do they end up? In darkness. But over here, his people, they're in light, which takes the energy of God. That takes the positive participation of God in order for there to be light. And so he enlightens the area where his people are. I think there's a very serious typology going on here. God continues to enlighten and supply light to his people because he chose them. So they did not see one another, verse 23. No one rose from his place for 3 days. So then Pharaoh called to Moses and said, go serve the Lord. Now every time he's done this, every time he has said okay, remember he's always put a caveat on it. So he's like, okay, you can go, or you and the men can go, or just you and Aaron and a couple others can go. Okay, you can go, but you can't take your kids. So it was always something that would make the slaves come back, because he's not about to say, yes, the entire slave community can now leave and go out into the wilderness and we may never see you again. So he always wanted them to leave something behind, some failsafe, some token that they'd be back. So he tries to pull that one again. By the way, so far Moses never fell for it, but he's going to try it again. So Pharaoh called to Moses and said, go serve the Lord, only let your flocks and your herds be detained, and even your little ones may go with you. Now last time he said, don't take your little ones. Now he's like, yeah, you can take the little ones. Oh, but all your animals, all your flocks, your herds, they have to stay here. Now, what is the purpose for which Moses and the Israelites are being called out into the wilderness?
To worship God.
To worship God, which would include
sacrifice.
Yeah, so Pharaoh says, yeah, you can go worship your God, but don't take any animals. You can't worship your God. So, of course, verse 25, Moses said, you must also let us have sacrifices and burnt offerings that we may sacrifice them to the Lord our God. Therefore, our livestock too will go with us. Not a hoof will be left behind. For we shall take some of them to serve the Lord our God, and until we arrive there, we ourselves do not know with what we shall serve the Lord. Isn't that interesting? He says we have to take everything because we don't know when we get there what God's going to require. We don't know yet what all God's going to want from us. So we have to take everything. Now, of course, one of the things that we may get to tonight is that God is going to tell Moses, now have all the women go around and collect as much stuff as they can get from their neighbors. Borrow everything you can, because by now they're so anxious to get rid of you. They'll be so happy to see you leave, they'll just give you stuff. And then, of course, God is going to not only give Israel all the wealth of Egypt and their flocks and their herds and their gold and their silver and everything, but then he's going to drown their debtors, which is a good deal. And then God's going to take them to Sinai and say, okay, now remember all that gold and all that silver and all that fine raiment and all that stuff that you got? Now I need an offering. Well, he could never have taken up an offering from people who had nothing. Take a bunch of impoverished slaves out into the wilderness and say, okay, I need an offering. Not going to happen. So first God made sure to provide everything that they needed for the offering, and then he came and asked for an offering. Almost like he planned it out. Or he just got really lucky. And so, therefore, we have to take all our livestock too, and not a hoof will be left behind. So verse 27, but the Lord, how many times have we seen this? But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he was not willing to let them go. In that one little verse, verse 27, we one more time see both sides of that equation. Did Pharaoh harden Pharaoh's heart? Yeah. Yeah, of course. Did Pharaoh refuse to let them go? Yes. Did Pharaoh do exactly what Pharaoh wanted to do? Absolutely. And he did exactly what God said at the very beginning he would do. I'm going to harden his heart so that he will not let you go, so that I can punish him, so that I can make a mockery of all the gods of Egypt. So this is all playing out in God's plan, but notice that God very freely, very comfortably, and with no excuses, is not interested whatsoever in Pharaoh's free will. He makes sure that he's going to work his plan through Pharaoh, and he hardens Pharaoh so that Pharaoh will not let them go, so that he can kill all the firstborn, which he said at the beginning he was going to do. Because Pharaoh had kept Israel, who were God's firstborn, in bondage for 400 years, God was determined to take Egypt's firstborn, and he was going to keep hardening Pharaoh's heart until he accomplished that. So one more time, did Pharaoh do what he wanted to do? Yes, absolutely. Did he do exactly what God intended he would do? Yes, absolutely. It's an absolutely sovereign God who does not change and still works exactly that way. So the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he was not willing to let them go. Then Pharaoh said to him, get away from me. Beware, do not see my face again. For in the day that you will see my face, this is the first time Pharaoh has put this threat out, the next time you come to me. Because Moses keeps showing up and pronouncing these terrible things. So Pharaoh says, this is it. This is what I'll do. I, after all, am Pharaoh. I am an incarnate God. I say who lives, I say who dies. I am a sovereign on his throne. Moses, if you come in here again, you're a dead man. I will kill you. So what's the next thing God does to Pharaoh? Starts killing people. And Pharaoh is incapable of stopping it. And all the gods of Egypt are incapable of stopping it. And no matter how much they cry out and pray to their gods as their children are dying, they're incapable of stopping it because there's only one God, he does what he wants to do, and all of the other man-made fictitious gods mean nothing in the eyes of the God who is. So Moses said, you are right. I will never see your face again. So yeah, so what does Moses know? Moses knows that they're leaving. The Israelites are going. we are going to pack up. We're going to take every animal, every hoof. We're going to take all our people, and we're going to be leaving here soon, despite the fact that you said that I can never come see your face again because you think you're in charge. The truth is you're never going to see my face again because God's in charge, and he's never going to allow me to come here again and tell you anything. Now, this really gets interesting because from this point forward, God says, okay, I have one more plague. And at this point, he makes an enormous division between his people and the Egyptians who are not his people. And this particular plague, this particular division is death is coming, and I'm not going to tell some people how to avoid it. And not just death, a terrible death, death of your firstborn, death in the night of your firstborn child. And I'm not going to bother to tell you how to avoid it. In all of the previous plagues, Moses went in and said, look, God's going to bring hail. He said, let my people go, or I'll bring hail. If Pharaoh at any point had said, okay, you can go, he could have avoided that plague. But God kept hardening his heart and hardening his heart until it culminates in the death of the firstborn, and you'll notice God doesn't tell Pharaoh or any Egyptian how to avoid it. At this point, he tells Moses, go tell the Israelites what I'm going to do and tell them how to avoid the death. And from this point forward, there's all of this typology that starts building because this is the way God always works with his people. He has been telling us, we've got a Bible full of it, how to avoid the death. There's a judgment coming. There's a death called the second death in the book of Revelation. There's the judgment of God waiting. It's appointed unto man to die once, and then the judgment. That's a reality. And yet God told some people how to avoid it. And yet he seems to be under no obligation to tell everybody. He didn't tell the Egyptians. He didn't tell anybody else on the planet. He only told the Israelites how to avoid the death angel. Why did he tell the Israelites? Was it because they were that good?
No.
No, we haven't seen anything out of them yet that shows they're that good. Like I keep saying, they're going to get out in the wilderness and just complain and moan and whine for 40 years about what a rough trip it is. Every day, God is going to give them bread from heaven, and these people are going to go, you know, we are so sick of bread every day. Oh, now we just want quail. Oh, I would love some meat. Sometimes they go to Moses and say, well, at least when we were slaves in Egypt, you know, we had leeks and onions and garlic to eat. Ooh, those were good days. Remember those good slave days when we used to have plenty of food? I mean, these crazy people. God is going to take them through the Red Sea. And yet, as soon as they get to Sinai, Moses is going to go up and start receiving the law from God. They're going to be down there building a golden calf and saying, behold, Israel, here's your God that delivered you. These are not good people. And yet God is going to redeem them out of Egypt and tell them how to avoid the death for one reason. Because he chose them. And that's the only excuse, the only reason, the only rationale for why they're delivered from the death angel. So, starting at chapter 11, now the Lord said to Moses, one more plague I will bring on Pharaoh and on Egypt, and after that, he will let you go from here. What has he said with each successive plague so far? He said, he won't let you go. Go tell him that we're going to do these things, but he won't let you go. It's the first time that God said, I'm going to do one more thing, and then he will let you go. What you have to understand here is that not only is God beginning to create this perfect typology of deliverance through Christ, through his Son, but what he's about to do, he's going to tell the Israelites to commemorate for as long as there is Israel on the planet. This is such an important event that he's going to tell Moses, rewrite your calendar. And this is now the first month on your calendar. And on the 14th day of the first month, the month of Abib, called Nisan, on the 14th of that month, every year you stop and you commemorate this. And when your children come and say, what is this and why do we do this? You're going to tell them this story of what I did and how I loved you and delivered you and separated you and called you my own, and you're going to keep telling this story forever. And when Jesus walks on the planet, he's going to die exactly on the 14th of Nisan. And Paul is going to pick it up and call him our Passover lamb. And so even as God is doing this, he is making sure that they're going to be delivered on this very night, on this particular date, because 1,400 years later, his son is going to die this particular date after he has kept this particular feast with his disciples in the upper room, and then he's going to be the Passover lamb for Israel. God is setting up 1,400 years in advance what he's going to do when his son gets here. You understand what I'm talking about? See, this is the God I'm talking about. I'm talking about that big God who is in such control of human history that he can talk about what he's going to do 1,400 years from now in perfect detail. And then tell the Israelites, now do this and never stop doing it. And then Jesus will walk on the planet and say, let me tell you why you've been doing this all this time. It's all about me. Now every time you drink this cup, now every time you eat this bread, do this in remembrance of me. And he's going to show them that all of this stuff they've been doing that they didn't understand why, and God was laying out all these strict rules. Do it this way. Do it this month. Do it this day. Don't ever miss it. Make sure you do it. They're going to understand the importance of it because it was all pointing to what God was eventually going to do in sending his son to be the Messiah of Israel. So we're talking about a very big God who's in control of the warp and woof of human history. And I just managed to use the phrase warp and woof in a sentence. Thank you very much. I probably won't be that literate the whole rest of the night. Verse 2. No, verse 1, he says, after this, he will let you go. You will be leaving here. When he lets you go, he will surely drive you out from here completely. Remember all the deals Pharaoh was making? You can go, but not them. You can go, but don't take your animals. Moses said, no, everybody's going, and we're not leaving a hoof behind. God now confirms that. God now says, not only are you leaving here, Pharaoh will drive you out. He's going to want you gone so bad that he's going to want you out of his country completely. Which, by the way, I guess we can take the time then to comment. So is God going to leave any of his chosen behind? No, he never has. Okay, I won't get into the left behind books. I'll just say the God of the Bible doesn't ever leave any of his behind, ever. Speak now in the hearing of the people, that each man ask from his neighbor and each woman from her neighbor for articles of silver and articles of gold. And the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Do you realize what that says? First he said, now go and borrow gold and silver, rams and stuff from your neighbors. And then it says that God actually acted on the hearts of the Egyptians so that they would want to give their stuff to the Israelites. So God showed favor among the Israelites so that the Egyptians would give them stuff. Now, why did God do that? Is it because God is into the health, wealth, prosperity doctrine? Is it because he knew Joel Osteen was coming and he thought, I got to set this up? Is that why he did it? No, I already gave you the answer. He did it because he was going to take an offering later. He's going to build a tabernacle in the wilderness. He's going to build a place, a tent of meeting, and in it he's going to require a whole lot of gold and brass furniture. And it's all going to redound to his glory. And in fact, your average Israelite on the street, okay, your average Israelite in the desert would never in his whole life ever get to go into the tent of meeting, because that was a place reserved for the worship of God. God himself would say who could go in there, which priests, which Levites, the high priest, only once a year. All of that kind of stuff God was going to lay out, which means that the offering he was taking was to build a place where God would rest among his people, and that would be where his worship was, and Israel would always be aware that God was in their midst. So much so that he lays out the 12 tribes, 3 to the north, 3 to the south, 3 to the east, 3 to the west, and the tabernacle was always right in the center of their camp, so that they always knew that God was right there in the midst. But in order to build it the way he wanted it, with all the glory he wanted, and the gold he wanted, and the brass and the silver he wanted, he first had to give them all the stuff it took to build what he was going to want them to build. So God's planning way ahead here is my point. And I'm sure that night they were really excited. You know that these slaves, remember these are slaves, who were going home with gold and silver and earrings and bracelets and raiment and going, we made out tonight. They were really feeling good about what they accumulated that night. Little did they know that later God was going to deliver them and say, okay, remember all that stuff I gave you? I need an offering. And it's the only place in the Bible, when Moses takes up that offering, it's the only place in the Bible you'll ever find where finally the men come to Moses and say, okay, stop the offering, it's too much. It's the only offering in the Bible that ever reached the point of too much, which means that God didn't just supply what he needed, he oversupplied. So that's a good God to deal with. That's, I know I'm making all these huge leaps back and forth, but I don't want to read through this text and not connect all these dots so that you can see that everything God's doing right here is very specific, very purposeful, because he's working out a very big plan that culminates in the arrival of his son. So the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Furthermore, the man Moses himself was greatly esteemed in the land of Egypt, both in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of the people. Yeah, you would think this is the guy who can make it dark for 3 days. He's going to be pretty highly esteemed after that one. And Moses said, thus says the Lord, about midnight I am going out into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of the Pharaoh who sits on the throne, even to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the millstones. All the firstborn of the cattle will die as well. Moreover, there shall be a great cry in all the land of Egypt, such as there has not been before, and such as shall never be again. But against any of the sons of Israel, a dog shall not even bark at them, whether against man or beast, that you may understand how the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. See, this whole choosing, electing thing, this is nothing new. This is nothing that Paul made up, you know, late in the church's history and said, hey, you know, I think I'll create the doctrine of election and add that to our Christian theology. All the way back here, you've got God saying that he wants both the Egyptians and the Israelites to understand that God makes a distinction between the Egyptians and the Israelites. And the Egyptians who have been suffering, your average Egyptian on the street, what did I call him a few weeks ago? Joe Six-Pack Egyptian?
Joe Bob.
Joe Bob Six-Pack Egyptian. He's not involved in any of this. Notice what it just said. From Pharaoh's child to the slave girl working behind the millstone. That means from the very richest to the very poorest, and among all the cattle, every firstborn dies. Now, when we read that, there's a sense in which that seems just cruel. There's a sense in which we think, how can God do such a thing? How can God just sweep through a whole nation and kill off all the firstborn when he himself is the one who hardened Pharaoh's heart so that they wouldn't go? Does the slave girl behind the millstone, does she deserve this? I'll ask it again now that you've had a chance to think. Does the slave girl behind the millstone deserve this? See, humanistic thinking says, no, she doesn't deserve it. She's done nothing wrong. Wait. She's never worshiped God. She's a sinner by nature. She's a rebel. She's an enemy of God. Oh, yeah, actually, she does deserve this. Does Israel deserve the deliverance they're about to get?
No.
No way. So why are they being delivered? Grace, 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 grace. God is being gracious to them because he chose them, because he's a gracious God, and he's keeping a promise he made to Abraham that he would bring them back to that very land. And God is keeping that promise among, like I said, whiny, he's going to call them backsliding Israel, rebellious Israel, and nevertheless, God's. And God said, so I'm going to make sure that Israel and the Egyptians know that I make a distinction between my people and those other people. Isn't that the same God we're dealing with today? Did God change? Did anything in the character and nature of God change? Then God is still in the enterprise of making a distinction between his people and those that are not his people. Have you ever had to try to talk to somebody about the things of God and have them just look at you with that deer in the headlights look? And you just know that no matter how hard you try, they just aren't going to understand it. You know, we've all had that experience. Testifying. I've had the experience of preaching messages to a room full of people and had people come up and say, wow, I just really got that. That really meant something to me. I really understood that. While somebody else would come in here, a visitor that would just, I've had people stand up and just walk out. It's like, oh, I'm done here. And up and out they walk. And I think, well, God is still in the business of making a distinction between his people and those that just aren't. Paul talks about it. He says that same word has the scent of life unto life to those people that are his. We hear the word of God and we just go, yeah, give me that. That's sheep food. I need that. And he said that same word has the scent of death on it to those people who don't belong to God. And they come in and they hear the word of God and they reject it and they hate it and it tastes bad to them and they can't wait to get away from it because God is still in the business of making a distinction between his people and the rest of the world. And it's not, one more time, it is not, nor has it ever been, nor is it ever going to be because of the quality of the people he's choosing. He's going to be choosing according to his grace. And that's been the picture all the way along. It's the same thing he's doing back here among the Egyptians. You've got the Egyptians and you've got the Israelites, and the only difference between them in terms of character or morality or enlightenment, the only difference between them is God chose this group and he didn't choose this group. And so he's going to make sure that the Israelites know all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, verse 5, shall die. From the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on the throne, even to the firstborn of the slave girl who's behind the millstone, all the firstborn of the cattle as well. Moreover, there shall be a great cry in the land of Egypt, such as never before been heard. But against any of the sons of Israel, a dog shall not even bark, whether against a man or a beast, that you may understand how the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. God has always, always been in the business of making distinctions. Verse 8, we're nearly done for tonight. And all these your servants will come down to me and bow themselves before me, saying, go out, you and all the people who follow you, and after that I will go out. And he went out from Pharaoh in hot anger. And then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh will not listen to you, so that my wonders will be multiplied in the land of Egypt. And Moses and Aaron performed all these wonders before Pharaoh, yet the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the sons of Israel go out of this land. Chapter 12 then is going to begin with the Lord saying to Moses and Aaron, this month is the beginning of months for you. It'll be the first month of the year for you. So tell all the congregation of Israel that on the 10th of every month, they're going to go take a lamb for themselves. And when they get their lamb, they're going to take it in the house, keep it until the 14th day, little baby spotless lamb. And then on the 14th, the night of the 14th, they're going to kill it in front of the kids and everything. They got to slice its neck open. They got to let the blood run. And then they have to roast it, and then they have to eat it. But when they eat it, they got to eat it with their sandals on their feet. They got to be fully dressed. They got to have their walking stick in hand, and they got to be ready to go. And God is going to institute the Passover that becomes the typology for deliverance and redemption for the whole rest of the Bible, culminating in Christ, our Passover Lamb, walking onto the stage of history to deliver his people. So we'll start there at chapter 12 next week. Yeah, we'll be here next week. And then the week after, which is the Wednesday between Christmas and New Year's, we're not here. Any questions about that? I know that I'm emphasizing it from a particular point of view, but I think it is the point of view that Moses was attempting to bring out of the text because it is so consistent with all the ways that Paul picks it up in the New Testament and uses all of this Egypt account to prove God's absolute sovereignty in his electing grace. When you read Paul writing in Romans 8 and 9, one of his many great treatises on God electing whom he will, he goes right for Pharaoh and says, God did all that, so that his election by grace would stand. That's why he's doing these things. Paul concludes, so then he will have mercy on whom he'll have mercy, and whom he will, he hardens. And that New Testament concept that lays at the heart of election doctrine and theology, Paul got right from this tale. So that's why I'm trying to pull all that out of it as we go through it, so that we'll see that God has never changed. This is what God has always been like. Nothing we're saying on Sunday mornings is any different than what Genesis and Exodus says. And it's the same thing that Revelation says. And it's the same thing that Job says. And it's the same thing that Isaiah says. And, well, you get the idea. It's the same God through the whole Bible being exactly the same way. And the way he is absolutely sovereign, doing whatever he wants to do. And if in the midst of doing what he wants to do, he chose to save you, well, that's just a remarkable act of grace. So say thank you. Anything else? Yes, ma'am.
I just want to let you know about how you've given me kind of an epiphany here about the whole communion thing. When we first started coming here, I was like, but they don't, there's no communion. Where's my communion? And then, you know, it was explained to me about Passover, and that's how you
right.
do it here.
Yeah.
And I kind of got it, but I went to Christian schools all through all of my school, and it was never explained to me that that supper was
Passover.
The new supper.
Yeah. Right. Because God said, and you're going to see it coming up, and then it becomes part of the law. It's keep doing the Passover. This was such an important thing to Israel. Keep doing it, keep doing it. Jesus didn't stop them from keeping Passover. Instead, what he said was, now as often as you do it. Well, how often do they do it?
Once a year.
Once a year. And he said, as often as you drink this cup and eat this bread, which was the unleavened bread that was specific to Passover, he said, now as often as you, talking to Israelites in the room, as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, instead of remembering Egypt, remember me. Remember the deliverance I'm giving you.
I get it.
Yeah, it click. And so all we're doing here is trying to continue to be biblical, even though that runs afoul of people's traditions. That's one of the questions that everybody who comes here new, that comes up. When do you do communion and how do you do communion? You know, why do you do it the way you do it? And so, yeah, we're just trying very hard to say.
I went and read up online.
Yeah, so you knew what the background was, yeah.
Well, after I, you know, didn't see any communion.
Sure. Isn't it nice when the pieces click, though?
It's very cool, and it makes perfect sense, and I don't understand how I got through so many years, and nobody ever.
She's laughing at you up here.
Oh, yeah, we've all been there. Yeah. We've all said exactly
yeah.
what
Where
you're
was
saying.
That?
Yeah.
Where was that? It was all in here.
Did they not know?
It was just read the wrong way.
The people who did
or not
at
read
all,
at all.
You would just say it was tradition.
Tradition. People love their tradition. The vast, vast majority of what goes on under the name of Christianity is just tradition that just gets recycled, recycled, recycled. So that when you say something, like when I say, you know, I'm not a huge fan of Christmas, and people go, oh, I thought you were a Christian. And I go, no, it's because I'm a Christian that I'm not a huge fan of Christmas. And that sounds strange to people. Uh-huh. Or, you know, that I refuse to call Resurrection Sunday Easter because it's the name of a foreign goddess. It seems to me that on the day that we're talking about the resurrection of the Son of God, the last thing we should do is stamp the name of a foreign goddess onto it. But then people go, you are so radical. You are so out there. What is wrong with you? And I'm just trying to be consistent to the God of the Bible. That's all I'm trying to do. So the same thing with communion. People have a set of gears because they grew up just doing it once a month or once a week. Or I was an acolyte in the Lutheran church, and I always knew that, you know, you light the candles on this side, you light the candles on that side. But on the first Sunday of the month, you stop and bow in the middle and light the two communion candles.
Episcopal, we did it every week.
Well, there you go. But you never knew why, did you? You just did it.
Well, I knew that was how we.
That's what we do.
That was.
Right, that's what we do. And isn't that the very definition of what a tradition is?
Yeah.
It's what we do. Without giving it much thought, we just do it.
But I'm okay with that now.
Good.
I missed it, you know, when I told John.
Yeah.
I love it here.
Yeah.
But I will miss that.
Be here.
Tonight I'm okay with that.
Good. I'm glad. That's a real epiphany. Be here in April and over homecoming weekend, which happens over the Resurrection Sunday weekend, we have our communion service. And there are people who travel to be here that Sunday because it's one of the most emotional and fulfilling Sundays we have, because it becomes really, really special. But in any case, my point being, there's two sides to that. One is, this is how the Bible says to do it, and so we're continuing what I believe is the biblical mandate. But the people who do communion every week or tack it on, you know, whatever, I am also convinced that they're not taking Paul's warnings to the Corinthian church seriously enough, because he actually does say that you're eating and drinking damnation to yourselves because you're not discerning the Lord's body, because they had tacked it on as part of their tradition. And they would keep a love feast, and some would be drunk, and some would be fed, and some would be hungry, and then they would take the Lord's Supper. And he said, you know, don't you have houses to go eat and drink in? And then he says, when you get together as a church, it's not to take the Lord's Supper. I mean, they had abused it too, and Paul was very specific to say, you're doing it so wrong. He said, there are some among you that are sick, and there are some among you that are dead because of how wrong you're doing communion. Well, if you take those words seriously at all, there's only two places in the New Testament where God killed people. One was lying about their giving, and the other was taking communion wrong. Well, if God is so serious about it that he'll kill people over it or make them sick to correct them, we ought to think about what we're doing here, you know? Maybe we should see if we're doing this biblically. So I many years ago, just decided to get serious about the whole communion thing, and I knew that there was going to be resistance, and I knew people were going to say, oh, my tradition. But the people who had the epiphany like you just had go, I get it now, and it's so much more special and so much more meaningful now that I understand that I am connected to 3,400 years of people stopping to commemorate the deliverance that God has brought them.
I'm really way looking forward to it now.
There you go. So am I then. We're good.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.